Kjolig misjetren, høydan elgeleling vehåg, og hun og mark og herrene, beordne døga sin sjøkår. Es fyr marreisne skjeldom, som medkjen nar frigom så. Han går hiser og varant leve, ikke fikk interline sjål.
The praises of Yves Leire have been sung before now. That wild lakeland between Macroom and Gugonborra in West Cork has been praised by the scribes of the Book of Leinster, by Angus the Culdee in the 8th century, by Mael Mido O'Gormoyne in the 12th, by almost every foreign traveller since then, and in our own time by many of the major literary figures, O'Connor, O'Faloin, Corkery and O'Riordan among them. A song, a very famous song, written by a girl from Yves Leire 150 years ago, gave us an excuse to add to the tributes and to sketch the extraordinary literary history of this lovely countryside. This is the country of Borra, of Máire Mhuine Leire, of Paddy Buckley the tailor and his wife Anstey, the home from home and the inspiration of Corkery, O'Faloin and O'Connor. It was the cradle for the revival of the Irish language in the early days of the century, and against all the odds, part of it is still a Gaeltacht. If you visit the place, take the road from Macroom to Inchigeelach, through Béalachanreirig, up to Rindov to Gugan Borra. Gugan is the focal point of the region. Here on an island in the lake, in the shadow of the mountains that separate Cork from Kerry, Borra the Saint founded his hermitage in the 6th century. Here the literary history of the region began. The English writer and artist Robert Gibbings fell in love with the place. He said of it,
"The road winds with the river, at one moment level beside untroubled waters, in a wide valley where lapwings wheel. At the next, tortuous above a torrent where salmon leap. Then for a while, calmly, tracing the contours of lake shores, with range upon range of hills to the south and west, the cones of Sheehy and Dúchail high above them all. Finally, a game of hide-and-seek among the crags and heather-covered ridges, the road a track, the lee a tarn, and the smell of turf fires sweet in the air. Ochre and lavender of heath and rocks, and gold of bursting gorse, silver of lichens and the ink-green ling, and coral red of myrtle buds. One last mile of twists and turns, sharp hills and sudden dips, and then Gugan. In old times, one needed to wash in Jordan to be cleansed. One needed to dip in Siloam for sight to be restored. But today, merely to stand beside the lake at Gugan Borra brings to one's whole being a peace beyond the telling."
Lochirke they called the place before the people renamed it in Borra's honour. An early life of the saint says, "Ro atrib irshin baide a Lochirke agus an atrgabail rishinir, agus is a skull robo ag Borra insan loch, oling a itte."
After this, Borra dwelt on Lochirke in Ethergol to the east of the lake, and this was the school that Borra had on the lake. Oling was his tutor.
The litany of the Book of Leinster tells us that in time the hermitage grew to be a large monastery.
750s of holy bishops, 750s of priests, 750s of deacons, 750s of subdeacons, with all holy monks endowed with the grace of God at Lochirke, on the borders of Muscri and Iacha Cruada. Utdicitor, the commemoration of Lochirke, wherein is a little bell melodious. Many as leaves on the branches are the saints that are therein. Hos omnes invoco in auxilium meum.
The commemoration of St. Finbar and his hermitage in ancient Irish poetry is extensive. Angus the Cailleadh Dane, not more than 2 centuries after Borra's death, wrote, "Iachach o carn go corquig suas er alne, as e aron a rat rede er cool baide."
Iachach, the lovely land from Cork to Mizzen Head, are under the protection of Borra.
Another old quatrain, this one from the 9th century, says,
"Borra, the fire of wisdom, loves humility to men of the world. He never saw in want a person that he did not relieve."
And the 12th century martyrology of Mael Mide O'Gormoyne also refers to Borra's love of the poor.
"May chaste Borra from Corkig be before me in heaven, for he was good and kind to God's poor.
God's poor have been coming in pilgrimage to Gugan Barra from the foundation of the hermitage. There is no evidence that it was anything more than a local pilgrimage until the beginning of the 18th century, however. O'Sullivan Beira passed the lake by without praying at Barra Shrine on the famous retreat from Glengariff. Ballyvourne was indulgenced by the Pope in 1601, but Gugan was not. Neither did Sir Philip Cox mention the place in his Regnum Carcagiense, published in 1687, although he dwelt at length on the neighbouring shrine at Ballyvourne. But due to the zeal of a calced Carmelite monk, Father O'Mahony, in the early days of the 18th century, the local pilgrimage became famous all over Munster. Charles Smith wrote in his book The Ancient and Present State of the County and City of Cork in 1750.
This place, Gugan Barra, since the time of St. Finbar, has been frequented by many devotees as a place of pilgrimage, and to get to it is little less than to perform one. In the island are the ruins of a chapel with some small cells, a kitchen and other conveniences, erected by a late recluse, Father O'Mahony, who lived a hermit in this spot 28 years. Round part of the lake is a pleasant green bank, with a narrow causeway from it to the island. That part of the island unbuilt upon, Father Mahony converted into a garden, planted several fruit trees in it with his own hands, and made it a luxurious spot for a hermit. He was buried here in 1728.
O'Mahony had failed in his efforts to get permission from Rome to supervise the pilgrimage. After his death, it became riotous, and in 1817 the Bishop of Cork formally excommunicated all those who visited Gugan on the feast of St. John in midsummer. Nowadays, the pilgrimage has resumed its ancient penitential character. Thousands come to pray at the island shrine from all over Munster, and for the local people it is a day of devotion to their own Barra, whom the scribe of the Book of Ballymote described so long ago as
Barra, crystal jewel of pearly splendour, golden salmon, angelic blossom, guardian tree, shield of the Gael, shelterer of the souls of his mountain people.
The solitude of Gugan continues to exert its influence on poets. Sean O'Riordan, born in the neighbouring parish of Ballyvourne, wrote one of his finest poems about the place. His was a private pilgrimage, Ilan agus Ilanelle.
Las mudan Ilan in Gugan Barra. Ta sasanach a gieskerach tzaloch, ta an irne ro laum an Ilan. Ach raide mask na gynis na gloch, sníhid le mŵr idim mŵrá loid. Raide nŵn is eistet sa na lán, eistet shal le smintis mar a nae vo himnig bar a nae fad a na lán, eistet lo in anihini a naeir. Aurus iar nol na lán. Ovaras even lom even is the hi, agus karim se átir of the sminti. Ach ni fistum un vuchin a sminti arim, mar ta deskar istus a mintin. Le breti gan vri, le baudin am lian, hurlin kluv lie mus minti. Mar chlehe kun leich da heilok ach jed, da trulich a gliv a mintin. Nivis lani vogan kluv lie da chanahe christ nu da sminti. Ta an teir mar vienfig manam na lí, vil baras a gí lína. Ta baras na nív na kienta sa chrie, stala pú kín a dvígu. Ta tirsim chrí dan okul gan drícht, bích dala nú diel hevra. On bígu. Ta rofli na ev san eir ma gúrd, san gaya fú al tríd, Ta padir hound chine leg is mus mint a shade rish. On sair vuele smint a naev, the lame whom savil nu, the huala tarkishne don tail is cohen vi clagger kyol. On kyol rachelish me, the bin ilan an ain, ni lane beon of wedi lan is true a horse might egg. Ilan gachéine. I vírne na hegine ta Ilan shéin, stus marinaun is triel fad yéin. Na bíchart éin chri hagaloid láhir héin, kega loshkishéd vahita, da husa féin. Mar nílun uta chaskine dúrt a sail, níl an otach cabúdeacht ó bhéal go béal. Cé gur cumachtúd féidir gil ar bhéal mhic dé, do scoilte sé do thosa ceart le dúil sa taol. Ach is peidir fós an tusa sin ar iláin sin, a an go ciúna cogarnaigh ar bhéola dé, nuair do rinci sé go machnasach ar ghoba taol. Iláin mhar an éifa. Tra an tháina ceach san uagán, ceoidh creime faile, do chuardaíos cór ar iláin, do fuiris é ag grana. Im himpel dascair crín chas áis, do bachra nocha leagan, do lúbardur ngach iláard, mar chorpa dóch na bheithig. Mar scríbhin breacair fór, scríbhin eile trasnair, chnúc geancus glúnus crittis spóg, fá dhúig, chnúc deurubh yendi. A vara hím lúbning éag gur tridach córach aonad, idir thosa dé is thosan taol, an sa id dheanclin naifa. Nuair a ghlanan ceann a feola lé tig áilecht aiti roca, sféidir cló a bheas an hain sa talas cnábach folof. Tá solt na sírse glóna grán, is gráad an túl i fiera, tá dúl sa rod tá casta caum, scráin don vugs don dírach. Is firin scríbin se na grán, níl cíoch ná cuar in éhaul, tá manach scríte vus is haul, sé bara lúb na ngéag seo. A ín sin tén ar lahas dé, ag sinna leán gachéine, an Crista tán a lisgé, an casta tán a viréte. Is fír vaca saúl dá iláin sén, iláin sa vara naifa, an Crista tán a ilisgé, an fúcaíocht at i ngéaga. An sasanach agus mehéin. Tá sasanach a gheascuireacht sa loch, smasam sé gur beag leis a taleán. Ach ní feasachtum nach gheascuireacht ar loch don sasanach a bheith únric ar iláin. Raid an ún is fágad a taleán, fágad sláán le smuinte smar a naibh, raid a celt na fírinim ar chách, raid an ún a cabúdeacht
In the 9th century, according to the Chronicles of Ireland, a collection of ancient hymns made by Meredith Hanmer in 1571, a hymn called Roptum o Vaile was chanted by the monks of Gugan. Sean O'Riordan transcribed it for, fittingly, Corchoshlí.
Rob me the vaxon.
few miles down the road from Gugon, there's a fine farmhouse owned this many a generation by people called de Bourke. Into this family, a girl called Maud of Weenie Laida married in the year 1792. It's hardly necessary to describe the times into which she was born. She lived through the age of the volunteers and the heady days of the French Revolution in 98. She saw the emergence of O'Connell as the new leader of the Irish nation, and she lived through the famine. She was a poet, and a good one, and though she never aspired to writing literature, she achieved it. Her most famous song commemorates a battle in the Tithe War, in which her sons fought, 150 years ago in January 1822. Andreas O'Meenehoin, who was born nearby, speaks about the Battle of Caymania and about the song.
In the opening decades of the last century, the British government's enforcement of the tithe levies had become so unbearable in most parts of the County Cork that large areas were in open revolt. In December 1821 and in January 1822, there were regular raids on the houses of landlords and their agents for firearms and ammunition. White by arms had been very meagre up to then. In the acquisition of arms by this means, the white boys of Weave Laida were not found wanting. On the night of the 10th and 11th of January in 1822, a party from Ballingarry and Caymania raided to good effect the houses of landlord, agents and camp followers in the Bantry district. Lord Bantry, having got word of this audacious act, mustered the local militia force and set out in pursuit of the raiders. Now, this retaliatory move the raiding party had anticipated, and they had taken precaution with some of their Bantry confederates that they should keep watch and warn should it materialize. So, no sooner had the militia moved eastwards from Bantry than a warning shout was raised from an overlooking hillock. This warning shout was taken up right along the suspected route, and thus was the alarm passed from mouth to mouth as far as Caymania and the upper regions of the Lee Valley. Then, and thus, having been forewarned of the approaching invasion, the Caymania and neighbouring white boys assembled to meet the challenge of the invaders. That is what Maude Vuí refers to in Caymania, her best known and most famous song, when she said, "An lugar leath a vadi gian, she duet gach fern ar walish triel, glueshi gamar tan cadarir agus temish na choir." Yes, she had heard and witnessed it all, living as she did at the time, quite adjacent to the eastern approach to the Pass of Caymania. When the militia arrived, the white boys had mobilized on the upland south of the River Lee, a short distance east of the Pass of Caymania. Now, in those days, there was no roadway through the pass as there is today. But there was what I might call a horse track along the mountainside of Duchel overlooking. It was by this track that the foot and mounted militia came. As they advanced, the ambushing white boy party opened fire. The militia took cover, a movement misinterpreted by the ambushers, who perhaps rather indiscreetly left cover and advanced in pursuit of the retreating militia, as they thought. The concealed militia immediately opened fire, killing two of the white boys. Then there ensued a lively skirmish and some hand-to-hand fighting, in the course of which Seamus Brenach of Turindove found himself confronted by a yeoman, John Smith. both set to fire, but somehow or other, each of their loaded guns failed. Siamus Brenach closed on his adversary, and he laid him low with a smack of his gunstock. At this point, Clohur Biolaire, a brother of the poet's, came on the scene. And seeing the yeoman attempt to reload, he advanced, stabbed him with his bayonet, inflicting a wound which proved fatal. Sometime later, the white boys were forced to retreat, their ammunition having been exhausted. Now, this encounter perpetuated in Mairuini Leda's famous Achan Kemenia took place 150 years ago in January
1822. Mardenan visa mi he can circa la so a machnav shaliam fening is a gain of mas muinte is a geist of the grill till la bin gan nion nor colan clear, it's glorn and yard the chocolate shames, la foy man are the and sleeve. Swarvein lianor, on the
It's almost heresy to say it, but I don't think Cachemania was Mairuini's best song. Pride of place I'd give to a song called A Varni Leido of Elachema. This song was written in 1843. It's a repeal song, and as one would expect, Maida placed her trust in O'Connell from Ivrach. It seems that the reformation of the Musgary yeomen under Sir Augustus Warren struck terror into the people of Ivleida and Musgary, and Maida in her song saw but one method of dealing with Warren, a method of which her hero O'Connell would no doubt disapprove. Volleys of bullets and sharp pikes in the brutes' bellies, everybody must be ready to attack them, God's curse on their company. They'll yet be down, without a possession under the sun, their hounds and beagles and horses gone from them, so that they'll have no further interest in gaming and the chase. A translation which doesn't, of course, do justice to the original.
Beg stella pleris peaky gera da gure medel vruidig, beg cloches kreaver ho lav gachenye is malach deira gumplacht. Beg shiet feyan lag fes balagrene, gan nachs a tail an a gurum, a gwyns a medels as a gapul treachta, gan doiling ngeim na a liuca.
This recording is an old one.
Mas a varni leir o vialachem, mar minun elit vail da muske heri men fjuk to god vel se du hin. Nu zak i shin e goi mok nu den nok si laun sa tev le du hyll no sok skeldet. Nere kurs i en tel kjøm på vil klanne gøl og gong grått. Da kåles gøl inn i nisle den i øyd og klev i noe hylgås i fokterme. Gann og vile næring dokker og bærer gulet. Go me ochretelers, vore si tren, agus kun of de da stjure, agus buinun verle. Gan fin, gan festen, agus kapler da rusken. Go nairin selesh, vidoi klemun, dogun shkel. Kutsle grasle mengdet harvnaevna herun vlatsa krevnu mudr no bishon hilskun gslakle deres vagen trele pudr tan karda tevlo le grasun en vik Så gjør han termer.
The tourist guides will tell you about Callanel's jingle. Many of us learned in our school days there is a green island in Lone Gugan Barra. Maud of we they haven't heard of, apparently. Her language is not known to them. But Irish is still spoken in Maud of we's country, and in the village of Bellon Huerig, in the early days of the national resurgence, a college was founded to help young men and women learn the beautiful Irish of Evel Éire. Here the old itinerant Irish teachers, the heroic Muntóirí Taistil, were trained, the men who travelled around the country teaching Irish in village halls and in schoolhouses and in country kitchens, at night, in the early days of Hyde's Gaelic League. That college in Ballingeary can boast of many famous pupils, O'Faoláin, Corkery and O'Connor among them. Sean O'Faoláin describes a blissful summer there learning Irish.
Less than 2 hours later, I got off my bicycle on the hillock outside Inchigeela, always afterwards to be my mark of arrival in the true West. Beyond the first foothills, across the loose stone walls of the road, the outcropping rock, the sparse wind-torn trees, the first few tiny fields excavated painfully by generations of cottiers out of a hard, infertile, sweat-making land softened only by the reed-edged lake, I saw the smoke-blue mountains now quite near. On their peaks, white clouds, larger far than themselves, rose into the blue sky. I heard over my head a lark trilling invisibly. And when I saw and felt all this, and knew that all about me people spoke an ancient tongue that I could as yet only partly interpret, I experienced the final obliteration of time that turns a moment into eternity. In that moment, the crude photograph at whose runic symbols I had gazed so often in the poems of Tomás Rua, the old ruined chapel near the ancient rocks edging the sea, became clear to me as a mirror. Remounting my bicycle with a pounding heart, I passed through my mirror into reality. I pedalled on, past the village, on beside its lake, now appearing, now disappearing, past small white cottages through the village of Bealán Ghoirich. After that, I came on the lee again, now a mere rocky stream, until I came to the farm and the farmhouse called Thúrin Dúf, where I was to stay. It wasn't a picturesque house, little in these parts except the scenery is picturesque. It was a plain, cement-fronted, slated house of two stories. I saw an uncombed garden in front, red with fuchsias and old cottage roses. I saw a long stone loft and byres of uncemented stone to its left. A new corrugated iron barn and more byres directly opposite across the road. Foothills rose rockily, front and rear. Later, my friend Christy Lucy, whom I first met in that house, was shot while trying to escape from it into those rocky foothills. At the end of the path down from the house beside the road, there was a well separated from the road by a light fuchsia hedge. As I got off my bicycle, I heard a girl's laugh from behind the fuchsias. And looking through it, I saw Eileen's brown eyes laughing at me between its scarlet bells. She came forward, still laughing with pleasure, dressed in a brown frock, her skin almost as brown, her black hair astray, her cheeks fuchsia red. And standing on one muscular leg, she looked at me as I did at her, quizzically and affectionately, our barrier and our bond. And then she brought me in and presented me to Benny Thoma. The old lady welcomed me in Irish as warmly as my old aunt Nan Ware back in Rathkeel would have done. And at once I felt I was at home. We proved to be a company of about 20 or 30 men and women, youths and girls, all as light-hearted as children. Their gaiety was something I've never experienced before or since. The women and girls shared rooms in the house. The men slept in the dry stone loft, which had been turned for the summer into a simple dormitory. We ate in separate sittings, about 10 at a time, at the long table in the dining room, and we always ate well. We spoke only Irish, often asking for a word or a phrase or a correct pronunciation from the more practiced. We'd come from all parts of Ireland. There were clerks, students, craftsmen, carpenters, masons, an electrical engineer. Two of them, who were more serious than the rest of us, had been in the Rising in Dublin and had been released from jail and the general amnesty of the year before. But all of us were reborn of that Rising and all that led to it, so that the language acted both as a matrix to the tissues of our political faith and as its sign and password. Our zeal to talk Irish bound us into a community. A new, glowing, persecuted or about to be persecuted political sect. One small sign of this was that we all adopted, and like myself, most of us retained for the rest of our lives, the ancient original Gaelic forms of our anglicised names, so that from being Whelan, I became and remain, as my children do, O'Fuiloin. We spent the livelong days together in groups. We spent half the day down in the village studying the language and the green corrugated tin shed, grandiosely called the college. The rest of the day we spent swimming in the rock pools or climbing the mountains or cycling to the farther glens or dancing informally by the roadside at night or more formally in the college or boating on the lake if the moon was up or simply sitting in the kitchen listening to some local boy or girl singing a traditional Irish song or playing old tunes on the fiddle. Or we merely sat and talked. Late hours were the common rule. I was always so pleasantly tired, so full of oxygen, I could have slept under the hedge or on the stone floor. On hot nights, I often slept in the clothes on which I stood, high up in the hay of the outdoor hay barn, waking only when I heard a horse's hooves on the road or somebody working in the stone byres below. Nowadays, the language that once spoke to teeming life and which is already speaking to fewer and fewer will soon speak only to ghosts. Bit by bit, the old life dies, the old symbols wither away, and I and my like who warmed our hands at the fires of the past are torn in two as we stand on this side of the bridge and look back in anguish at the doomed Ireland beyond it. We loved this valley, this lake, this ruined chapel, this rude cloister, because of their enclosure, their memories, their silence. Many times then and in after years we entered the silent, deadened coombe to climb the mountain beyond. Once we got lost there in a summer fog, aiming for the minute lock up there called the Lake of the Speckled Trout, dark as ink and cold as ice water, visited otherwise only by mountain sheep. When we reached the top of the coombe after some tough climbing, the fog lifted and we came on another valley and a vast view westward across other mountain tips far over the sunset sea. On those fortresses, what could touch us? We enjoyed among them what I may call a juvenile fantasy of grown desire, planning tiny cottages on either side of this lost valley or that facing one another, so that by day we would ascend to the lake and be together, and by night and see each the other's beckoning light across the darkness of the glen.
Undoubtedly, Cloisht and the Moon played a major part in the survival of Irish in the district of Eve Laira. It gave a fresh impetus to storytelling and to traditional singing. Diarmaid Ó Coitre was the last of the famous Seanchaithe of Eve Laira. Good as he wasn't as good, and he certainly wasn't as famous as the tailor of Gaora na Péice, Paddy Buckley. Paddy found his Boswell in Mr. Eric Cross. Mr. Cross's book was banned when it was first published in 1942. The tailor and his beautiful wife Anstey became the subject of a great debate in the Senate, and the book was deemed so obscene that quotations from it, read by Sir John Keane, who defended it, were ordered to be struck from the records of the House because, and it's on record, pornographers would buy the proceedings of the Irish Senate as an anthology of evil literature. The tailor and his wife, whose cottage was known to everybody who came to Eve Laira learning Irish, for their Irish was magnificent, suddenly became out of bounds. They were hounded by the clergy. The 75-year-old man was ordered onto his knees and made burn Mr. Cross's book by one zealous clergyman. Frank O'Connor paid both Mr. Cross and Mr. Buckley the compliment of including the tailor's account of the jury case in Gugan in his edition of Irish Short Stories for the World's Classics. It's read by Eamon Keane.
Was I ever telling you about the jury case we had up at the hotel? It wasn't really a trial, but a coroner's inquest. But they had a system very much like a trial in a courthouse. There was a jury, and they had to listen to the evidence and find out what had happened to the man and give their opinion. It all happened over a man who was found dead in the island. He had fallen over a bank, and a slab had fallen on top of him and broke his neck. Well, the following morning, the coroner and the sergeant came along. They were collecting a jury. There were 12 of us. There was the Sheep and Cork Echo and Danby Dam and the Rocky Mountaineer and several others. Some of them are dead now, may the Lord have mercy on them. There was a priest once preached a sermon on the 12 apostles, and was failing him to describe what type of men they were at all. He wanted to tell the people that they were just ordinary folk, that there was nothing grand or smart about them. So, after he had thought for a while, he said, "They were 12 working men, farmers and fishermen and such class of people. They were 12 ignorant men, as ignorant as any 12 men you'd find in this parish, and God knows, that wouldn't be difficult." Well, the 12 apostles were like the jury we had that day, as ignorant as any 12 men you would find in this parish. A divvly bit, but we all assembled and we struck away up to the hotel. They hadn't an idea what was going to happen to them. Some of them thought that they were going to be tried for killing the man. Others thought that they were going to his wake. And more of them thought that they were going to shoulder him to his grave. You see, it was the first time there had been a jury case in this district for many long years. And it was all a mystery to them, for none of them except myself had ever travelled. Good enough. We got to the hotel, and the body was lying in a room, and we all had a look at it. The poor fellow was dead enough, there was no doubt about that, God rest his soul. The coroner asked us if we recognised the man, and we did, but he was well known to most of us. After we all had our fill of the sight, we had a couple of more drinks, and then we went into the room where the case was to be tried. There were chairs for each of us, and the sergeant and the coroner were there. The sergeant told others that they would have to take the oath and swear in the book. Then Cork Echo spoke up. He hadn't said a word to this. He said that he wouldn't swear, because swearing was a sin. And he started quoting bits out of the catechism. He wasn't going to swear with his eyes open. Now, it'd be altogether different if he did it unannounced himself, but he hadn't enough drink taken yet. The sergeant started quoting bits from a book he had in his pocket, and then the coroner joined in, but they were only making a poor hand at the business. I explained it to him, and all about the business, and that battle was done with. To save time, we held the book in threes and took the oath together. When he came to Danby Dam, he said that he wanted to swear alone and he wouldn't put his hand in the book with anyone else. So he swore alone. He held the book as though it was going to bite him. And when he had his swearing done, he looked behind him as though he expected the devil was there waiting to take him. The sergeant and the coroner got out their notebooks ready and we were all set for the business. Just as we were going to start, the Sheep got up and started to go out. The coroner wanted to know where the hell he thought he was going, and the Sheep explained that he was going behind for he had drink taken, and his bladder was weak. So we waited for the sheep to return, and when he'd returned and sat down and lighted his pipe, we started again. The sergeant read his statement, and we listened. Then the man who had found the body told how he had come to find it, and the coroner asked if we accepted that. The year before, the man who had found the body had sold the Rocky Mountaineer a mare, and the mare was faulty. The Rocky Mountaineer didn't find this out until after the deal was made, and he could do nothing but wait till he got the chance of his man again, and this was his chance. I declare to God, didn't he say that the man was a liar, and that there was no one there at the time but him, and he might have pushed the man over the wall? Well, they had a few words, and the sergeant called the meeting to order. And the coroner wasn't able to make out what had happened until the sergeant explained the affair to him. And then the coroner understood and the business proceeded. The coroner explained what had happened and what sort of a verdict we could bring in. Either death by misadventure or fellow de se, or murder by person unknown. And he explained his own opinion. The Rocky Mountaineer jumped up and said it was plain murder, and he didn't care a damn what anyone else said, for he had had dealings with the man who found the body, and he'd swindled him over the sale of a horse. And if he would do that, murder was not in him. So we had that all over again. It was a very warm day, and the room was small, and what with the smoke and the arguments, we decided that a drink or two wouldn't do anyone any harm. So we retired for a drink or two, and when we came back, we took up the business where we'd left off. The coroner counted and found one missing. Sky High, who was one of the jury, had not come back. The sergeant went off to find him and found him on his way home and brought him back. He said it wasn't in his line at all, that he didn't understand it, and he had a cow at home that was due to calve, and he'd be better there. But the coroner made him stay. The coroner talked to them then about fellow the say, and he explained all about it to us. When he'd finished, Danby Dam got up and said that he couldn't understand it at all. How could the fellow fall into the sea, he asked, when the sea was 15 miles away as the crow flies? Be damn, I couldn't agree to that at all. Be damn, it could be fell into the lake, but be damn, it could never be fell into the sea. The coroner explained again, but Danby Dam couldn't understand him still. Be damn, if the fellow fell into the sea, he would be wet, wouldn't he? Be damn, but his clothes were quite dry. Here, be damn, it couldn't be that at all, but something other thing. The coroner explained suicide too, but Danby Dam hadn't heard of that either. He wanted to know if it was Irish. In the middle of this argument, there was a knock at the door, and in walked Bala Wax's wife with his dinner. She was the divil of a great pounder of a woman who would make a grand door for a car house. Now, Bala Wax is only a small class of a man, but he'd a fierce appetite, and his wife was afraid that he'd die if he didn't have his dinner. He was a great friend of Danby Dam's, and the two of them started on the dinner and forgot all about the inquest. Not that it mattered much, for the two of them were ever better at eating than they were at thinking. And the wife had brought up a grand potash of pig's head and cabbage and potatoes. At last, the business was coming to a head, and the coroner asked us to consider our verdict. Then the fun started. One said one thing and one another. The effects of the drink had worn off the Rocky Mountaineer, and he was all for murder again. The sheep said that he didn't understand it at all, and he would not care to give his opinion. That was with the height of madness. He wouldn't even give his opinion unless he was paid for it. Corkeco thought that the business was all wrong and that no good would ever come of it, and the less we had to do with it, the better. He hadn't got over the swearing part of it yet. I tried to knock sense into their heads, but by God, it was failing me. Now that Manby Dam had a belly full of food, he had an idea. Be damn, said he, doesn't the man say that it was death by misadventure? Be damn, isn't he from the government? Be damn, it wouldn't be right to agree with him so. We must say something else, be damn. Oh, there were others of them with queer notions, and there were some of them so scared stiff that they were just sitting like dummies and saying nothing at all. 12 good men and through, Umbasa. You'd search the earth before you'd find an equal pack of mugwumps of blathergashes. I went up to the coroner, who was a decent, sensible type of a man, and explained the position to him. We sent the rest of them into the bar for a drink, and I and the coroner settled the business between us, and we brought in a verdict of death by misadventure. And, of course, I added a vote of sympathy with the poor fellow's relations in their trouble, and we left the jury to drink itself stupid. But they could never do that if they were drinking to this day, for they were stupid before they started. 12 men, as ignorant as any 12 men you'd find in this parish, and God knows that it'd be easy enough, with their wake blathers, and their sins, and their cows calving, and their pig's head in cabbage, and their fell in the say.
On my last visit to Eve Lady some months ago, I asked the question that one is apt to ask in all of the Gaeltachtaí one visits, will Irish survive? Certainly there seemed to be more Irish spoken in 1971 than there was when I stayed in Mr. O'Fallon's beloved Tuadhín Dubh 17 years ago. I asked Anseo Somwinichain whether he thought Irish would survive in the glens of this beautiful land between Ballyhlan and Gugan, whether today's generation would deprive tomorrow's of a birthright as old as the sanctuary of Barra in the mountain lake. Sean O'Fallon is despondent. One hopes Anseo Somwinichain is right.
Ní ce mea chúis na maitach, agus taim lán túrál haga maitig. Agus se chúis gynéidim mea sin, na a véd teilach agus lín tí, a hím inis nár huga mochúr dead a náit, agus gailing ar fadar siúlacha, teilach cuidacha sanna vi garev eidhaka as an gailing nú i gamínta rompa, ach gwyd ché treis kasa har nás sin rígis ete, ta mi adúr hasan, agus mai lennan aulig, kunu sa vachéan vóial ar a náit.
Darling, bo vachan fwe, shiv dan te vachan nir shibroin, Then he er hula trede, no trefse ve haul er torn. No simdel hurtig eshtocht le herne ving timrot hjol. Mor him pol lesson herig, er heder las lin shol. I saling I rakel tag sedan amilan mor o hugan baran efa gafte ver fachis go ko blar na vina dre nor kil chegas tam wing klaro atra vasi hefele
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.